We present The Sound of Football.
On this week's Sound of Football, we review an exciting weekend of FA Cup football in which Stoke outbattled Arsene Wenger's Arsenal side, many of which we didn't even recognise. There was a draw for Leeds away to Tottenham, thanks in no small part to a cameo from former England Rugby Union player Matt Dawson. We'll also be discussing the immature antics of Tevez and Neville following last week's League Cup semi-final, plus the West Ham takeover and the African Nations Cup. All this and plenty more besides on your own, your very own Sound of Football. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another edition of the Sound of Football podcast with me, Chris Oakley, and my two chums from Some People on the Pitch and the Onion Bag, it's Graham Sibley and Terry DeFellum. Welcome aboard, gents.
Hello.
Another packed football week, as if there are any other varieties, and we'll start off this particular podcast by looking at the FA Cup fourth round, which was going on at the weekend. Quite a few interesting results, and indeed a few eyebrow-raising ones as well, and I'm sorry to say this, Graham, I can't break this to you any gently, but the big result, really, the big upset of the weekend was Stoke City's 3-1 win over Arsenal. Now, there's been a bit of discussion about Arsene Wenger's choice of players for the match. A few young players, a few unknowns in there, and a few sort of rarely used players. To my mind, I don't know what you sort of felt about this, Graham, and indeed how intrinsic it was to the result that arrived at the end, but it looked to me like Arsene Wenger was squarely putting his priority on the league campaign rather than the cup. Do you agree? And if so, do you think he was wrong to do that in any way?
I wouldn't presume to second guess Arsene Wenger when it comes to team selection for Arsenal. Personally, yes, he did put out a weakened side out there, an experimental side, if you're being generous. He obviously looked at the game, thought, you know, this is going to be a tough one. If Stoke really want to win this, if they want to go really want to go through, they're going to give Arsenal a really hard time, and they did. I mean, like, they played fantastically well, and deserved the win. You could see Arsenal have got their minds on the fact that they've got four huge games in the league in the next 2 weeks, and you know, if they ended up losing one of their bigger names in this game, then they could be staring down the fact of, like, you could be out of two competitions within the space of 2 weeks, and that has happened quite a lot for Arsenal in recent years. So I don't, you know, I can see, you know, it's disappointing. It's very disappointing when you see Arsenal go out in that manner. You know, it wasn't the prettiest game you've seen. It's like, you know, the Stoke,
typical Stoke match, basically.
Yeah, it's right. I mean, yeah, I suppose I wasn't really surprised when they put it on television, because they thought there is likely to be an upset here, and you know, it happened. ITV have been very, very lucky with their upsets this year. It seems to have sorted out very well for them.
Just going back to a point, I mean, you sort of saying about, you know, the prioritising towards the league campaign. Of course, during the week after our last podcast, Arsenal actually went top of the Premier League. So if that didn't kind of focus their attention on the fact that there is the potential there to win the Premier League this year, with all the other members of the Big Four being inconsistent, then that would have focused Wenger's mind all the more, wouldn't it?
Oh, certainly. I think, you know, it can't be forgotten that Arsenal have really been everyone's favourite to drop out of the Big Four in recent years, and including this season, everyone was thinking that it was going to be them that was going to drop out, and to be sort of like top of the league, so come the end of January, it's very heartening to see that even though it's the most sour faced people out there are probably saying, well, it's only because Man United and Chelsea are dropping points. But you could say that just because it's become more competitive, perhaps this season.
There are
lots of ways of looking at it. I mean, I think, you know, if Arsenal can go on this year and push on to get a comfortable second place, I think that would be a win. I don't think they'll win the title.
Of course, there's the European campaign to consider as well when that rolls around next month, but we'll deal with that in due course. Sol Campbell appeared in an Arsenal shirt for the first time in a fair old while. How did you feel he did on his return?
Okay, not too bad. I think it's, you know, he's not going to be first choice for Arsenal. He's going to be there as backup, and we need backup at centre-back. I think that's it.
Right, fair enough. Okay, well, there it is. Stoke progress to the next round. We'll have a look at the fifth round draw shortly. Of the other results that were going on, some wins for Premier League sides. Aston Villa 3-2 over Brighton. Fulham 1 away at Accrington Stanley, which could have been a potential banana skin, especially given Fulham's current form. But another big one, really. Not a full-blown upset, you understand, but the game between Tottenham and Leeds. Now, that finished 2-2. As we know, Terry, that Leeds' previous game in the FA Cup was, well, they basically knocked out Manchester United in the previous round. And I remember asking you before, how do you feel that Leeds would get on against Tottenham? And this, I'm not saying this deliberately to wind you up, but I remember you sort of saying, no, Tottenham will win. And I think probably most of us thought Tottenham will win. But to their credit, Leeds came back from behind twice against Tottenham and have forced a replay, and Tottenham will now have to go to Elland Road in that replay. How did you see Leeds' performance, and what do you rate on their prospects for the replay? He says trying to get you to fall into the same trap the second time around. No.
Well, there's a couple of things to point out there. One is I cannot believe that someone with as shonky a first touch as Jermaine Beckford gets as many goals. He reminds me of the Graham, you pointed this out before, about Miroslav Klose, who plays for Bayern Munich, the German international. Dreadful first touch. Nobody seems to know how he scores goals, and yet he does. So that's the first thing to record about it. I mean, the goal from open play that he scored. I mean, he sort of like he turned, and but the ball just seemed to sort of somehow find its way into the net from his left. I don't understand it.
Cole about him.
I mean, he obviously has a tremendous instinct, and that's it's great and fair play to him. But I mean, even that goal he scored against Manchester United was really made because he didn't control the ball properly. He ended up kicking it on, and then of course he could allowing him to skin Gary Neville, easily done, and scored a goal.
It does seem that he seems to score despite what he does, not because of what he does.
Yes, he's an extraordinary player. I mean, in a way, you know, you wonder whether or not maybe someone's had a word in his shell, like, and said, look, you do realise if you go and play for Newcastle, you know, they will expect a lot more from you, even more than Leeds do. You know, you'll be in the real spotlight. Maybe it would be better if you just stayed where you are. But I don't know, I'm sure that's not the case. The other thing about, of course, the draw is that it was all heading towards a win if it hadn't been for Matt Dawson's only one missed time challenge in the entire game. I mean, he was superb. Matt Dawson? Hang on, that's not right. He's a rugby player.
I knew you didn't mean that. I just thought I'd carry on. Just
a question of sport here. Never mind.
Matt Dawson.
That makes me see Barker. I'm worried.
How did he get that what happens next wrong? Honestly. Anyway, so, I mean, the thing is that all I can think of now is Matt Dawson, so I need a mental cue from one of you to tell me who I am actually talking about. The guy who gave away the penalty in the last minute for Leeds to get the equaliser. You don't know either, do you?
Michael Dawson, son of...
Anyway, the thing that gets me is that it was the only sort of like one missed time challenge from Dawson, you know, in the game pretty much, and it was the final one. And so, you know, it could quite easily have been, you know, much worse. So
I must admit, Pavlyuchenko's goal was utterly superb as well.
Yeah, well, when you hit that, talk about shop window for that one. Maybe that's sort of like how Harry sees it. But what can you say? You know, fair play to Leeds, and they've got an excellent chance at Elland Road. An excellent chance at Elland Road.
Some heroics on the part of the Leeds goalkeeper as well, I think is worth mentioning. Kasper Ankergren, I don't know how you pronounce it, he's a Danish goalkeeper, and he saved a penalty from Defoe early on, which undoubtedly put a bit of lead in the pencils of the Leeds players for the rest of the game. And another battling performance. Interestingly, Leeds, their league sort of performance suffered a bit after their Man U game, and I'm just wondering, Terry, where I was going to maybe briefly mention Crystal Palace's creditable 2-2 draw at Wolves. Is that something which, say, Championship teams can have to bear in mind, maybe that they may get a bit too sucked into any sort of good run they may have? Or is that the case generally, is it?
I don't know. Sorry, what was the question again?
But basically, is it from the point of view of a Championship side like Crystal Palace or indeed of Leeds in League One? If you get a sniff of sort of glory in the FA Cup, is it worth pursuing it when maybe you might kind of sacrifice your league form, especially if you're chasing promotion as Leeds are?
Well, I mean, from Leeds' point of view, I think that they should be mindful of the fact that they are obviously expected to be promoted this season. I think from Palace's point of view, I don't think anyone cares. I think one game follows the other. You know, I mean, it's just like that at Palace at the moment, because I mean, we could be in administration at the end of the month. We're selling our best players if anyone will buy them. You know what? I mean, I don't really mind. I don't really care what happens. I'm really looking forward to the replay and, you know, against Wolves. So I'm going to get to go along and see it and, you know, just take it like that, really. From Palace's point of view, I really don't mind. As long as they're still playing, I don't care.
Either or. Yeah. Well, fair enough. Okay, so an interesting fourth round to the Cup, and fifth round comes along again in a couple of weeks' time, as you can expect, and we could go through all the various matches there, but I think we'll come to that when the fifth round rolls around again, but some good matches there for sure. Briefly, in the Premier League, there was one game, that's Man United. They beat Hull City 4-0, and as if you hadn't already guessed, Rooney scored all four of those goals. But rewinding back to last week, again after our previous podcast, a bit of shenanigans going on, shall we say, in the League Cup semi-final first leg between Man United and Man City. And Tevez decided enough was enough, and you know, all this kind of flack that he was getting from Man United supporters, presumably on the basis that he left them rather than they got rid of him. And so, whereas previously he decided not to sort of celebrate too much when he scores against Man United, last week it was all a bit different, wasn't it, gents? And then we had all the fallout of that with who emerged. I didn't really realise until the following day in the newspapers these pictures of Gary Neville with his middle digit held aloft proudly in reaction to Tevez's baiting. Graham, coming to you first on that one. I mean, one would have to sort of say that Tevez is probably right under the circumstances, just to allow himself a bit of, you know, cut himself some slack on this, isn't he?
I think so, really. I mean, it's not like he ran 80 yards back up the pitch and did the eight-year-old at a wedding dive, did he? He was he basically sort of like, well, didn't he run up to the director's box, wasn't it? That he was gesturing to them and in the process ran past Gary Neville, who I saw Sky Sports, as is their wont, did the full slow-mo and did the
from six different angles,
yeah, and did the highlighting of Gary Neville, who was actually seen to spit as well at in the direction of Tevez as he ran past him.
He's quality, isn't he? He's a different class.
Which is one thing that I didn't hear too much about in the press. Everyone was going on about the one fingered salute, but there was quite he certainly made the motion of spitting out at Tevez. Oh, it's a rather disagreeable chap.
Yeah, I mean, I think the initial sort of thought was that Tevez had kind of cupped his hands behind his ears as a gesture to the entire Man United bench. Apparently, it was aimed only at Neville because of the fact that Neville had been criticising Tevez, the fact that, you know, he wasn't worth 25 million or something. And I thought it was rather cheeky the fact that Tevez sort of said, it wasn't aimed at Ferguson because Ferguson loves me, which is kind of like sort of, you know, him and me, he's like my dad, he is. But then we had the radio interview that Tevez did on Argentinian radio during the week, in which he kind of what did he call himself, like a moron or something? He called Neville a moron and so on. And then shortly afterwards proclaimed, no, a lot of it was lost in translation, which is a handy excuse to have, I suppose.
So they didn't mean to call him a moron. I meant to call him a twat.
Yeah.
I mean, how old are these people? I mean, if there are any impressionable young listeners listening to this, I don't know why you are, but if you are, this is not actually how men behave. This only happens in rare instances, like with footballers, because they're all children. You know, proper men conduct their affairs in a slightly more civilised manner, or at least I'm led to believe that they do anyway. It's just ridiculous. I mean, Gary Neville is what, how old? 4 or 34. It's just embarrassing. It's really embarrassing to sort of like see. You just can't believe. I mean, Gary Neville has got a quite a lucrative academy in Malta. And I don't know to what extent a lot of this is trying to keep himself in the public eye in order to continue to keep his profile high, in order to continue to, you know,
as his career his goes over the horizon.
I don't know when to be terribly cynical about this, but I mean, he's obviously on the wane. I mean, he's getting skinned by players like Jermaine Beckford for a start. You know, that's not a good thing. You know, and to do that, I mean, who cares what Carlos Tevez is or was or is to Manchester United or to Gary Neville? I mean, you know, if you're being taunted, just turn around. Turn your back on him. Surely, gosh. And, yeah, the war of words at four, you know, well, I mean, it's just something to talk about, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the ironic thing is, as a result of all this, it's undoubtedly probably inflamed the passionate feelings between the two sets of fans, United and City, ahead of this second leg that's going on Wednesday this week in a couple of days' time as we speak. And you've got Mancini on the one hand sort of saying, okay, well, let's just calm down, everyone. It's all just a bit of kind of, you know, hoo-ha, but nothing to get too excited about. And then Gary Cook comes along and completely neutralises what's been said before. So now you've got a situation where before this second leg, the police are on, like, high alert. They're probably frisking everyone going in for checking for darts and golf balls and any other sporting equipment they can smuggle in, as was found at the previous leg. It's all a bit of a jape and all, let's all laugh up our sleeves sort of thing at first. But actually, there is a slightly more sinister side to this, and you do have to wonder about how sort of responsible players like Gary Neville and maybe even Carlos Tevez have to be in this
Absolutely.
Situation.
I think that's a really good point, Chris. I mean, the Carling Cup has had a history of trouble this season at Upton Park and at Oakwell as well. With Manchester United supporters, and remember that they're not season ticket holders who get into these games. Yeah, so you can get all kinds of riffraff turning up there, and I think it's important that everybody maintain a cool head because, yeah, you know, season ticket holders at Old Trafford, you know, prawn sandwich brigade, blah rah rah rah, that's fine. But I mean, you know, disenfranchised Reds who can no longer afford to go along to the league matches, getting a hold of tickets turning up there, are going to be in a much more volatile mood. I think it's a really, really bad. I think all of this, I think you're absolutely right. The whole thing stinks, frankly, but I suppose to an extent it's all a good laugh, but hey-ho.
Well, I mean, if Man City do win again, or at least hold out for an aggregate win, they'll be through to the final. They'll be playing Aston Villa, which will be a good final for the neutrals. Aston Villa back in a cup final for the first time in 10 years, and it's been a farewell since Man City, been a final as well, so... I guess, at the risk of inflaming things even more, than maybe the neutral is going to be kind of more interested in seeing City win. But we'll see. I think, as long as there's a good match at the end of the day, most people will be happy. And the second leg is on Sky, out of interest, just in case any of you thought that perhaps BBC had kind of grabbed all the rights to these League Cup matches. But so it'll be on Sky this week. So there it is. A bit of fallout from that, but looking forward to the football again. Right. Mm. Now, something else that happened after the last podcast that we did last Monday was that my team, West Ham United, ended up being taken over. Hooray! We had to wait a long while for that. In fact, going back some weeks now, every time the press kind of probed West Ham and sort of said, is there going to be a takeover? The response was always, no, there's no rush for it. It's not going to happen for a long while yet. Forget about it. And yet... here we are. We're in a situation where at least last week, the doors were thrown open and the prospective bidders were invited in, and it was David Gold and David Sullivan who got the job, as it were. They've got a 50% stake in West Ham. Decisively, it's the sort of controlling stake. And so now we have an interesting situation where we've got about a week left of the January transfer window. We're going to wonder if we're going to see any last minute transfers coming in. And maybe West Ham's prospects are looking up a little bit. Maybe. As a sort of non West Ham fan, either of you, what was your sort of take on that whole affairs? Do you think it'll be a good thing for West Ham, or are we mixing with the wrong people?
Well, I mean, like, we can all have a good laugh at Messrs. Gold and Sullivan, basically, because they earn their money making dildos. So they're perfect fodder. You've got to look at the way that they ran Birmingham, and yes. And you know, they got Birmingham up into the top flight and into a decent team. And, you know, so if they do the same with, all right, the West Ham are already there, but, you know, if they can make West Ham as stable as Birmingham, then I should think, you know, most West Ham fans would be quite happy with that.
Mm, absolutely. Speaking as a West Ham fan, I'd certainly be happy with that. If they can keep West Ham up and then stabilise us, then, as you say, I think they did a very creditable job at Birmingham. I think they, when the time came to cash their chips in, I think they ended up making something like a £60 million profit there, which, no disrespect, but a club like Birmingham City is nothing short of a miracle, really. So, I mean, it's interesting, I think, in the first instance, of people sort of saying to me, oh, they're in it for to make a quick buck. And I'm thinking, well, if the first thing you have to do is to clear a £110 million debt,
yes,
I suspect that you're not going to make a quick buck out of this.
Chris, what do you think of the proposed move to the... forget Karen Brady's West Ham Olympic thingy. But, I mean, what do you think of the proposed move to the Olympic Stadium in time?
The thing with Upton Park is, speaking from experience, I mean, it's obviously a great old ground, lots of memories attached to the place, as people have been only too quick to point out, and I feel the same way. However, it's a stadium which has only got limited capacity for as long as I can remember. We've only been able to get the 37 odd thousand or something max into that ground, and it's usually anywhere between 30 and 35. Moving to the Olympic Stadium should ensure that maximum capacity goes up to 55,000, along with all the additional revenue that would generate. You've also got there's the transport links, because where Upton Park is located, for anyone that doesn't know, it's a really kind of cramped... I mean, it's sitting there, I think, as I wrote on an article last week, it's kind of sitting sort of cheek by jowl with houses and shops, and it's quite... cramped. When you go there on a match day, it feels like the whole world has turned up down this residential street. If you go to, you know, if they end up going 2 miles away to Stratford, you're suddenly in a location where there's much more space, much more room to breathe. The transport links are much better, and I think actually even the most diehard West Ham fans would actually find it a real breath of fresh air to go there. It would just be a wrench to have to leave behind the place where all those memories were created over the many years that have gone by. So. It fundamentally, I think, is a good thing. What's interesting is that Gold and Sullivan have been sort of suggesting that as one method of making back some of their money would be to sell off Upton Park. However, they've also at the same time suggested that there's this issue about the running track at the Olympic Stadium in London. And they've at the same time, they've also sort of said, oh, we'll put the Olympic track in Upton Park. Well, you can't put it in Upton Park and sell it. Or at least not expect to make the same amount of money by selling Upton Park if there's a running track in it. That causes all kinds of complications. So, there's lots of issues there. But it's kind of, to keep the agenda as open as possible, it's quite heartening to see that I don't know if it's the Minister for Sport or Minister for the Olympics or whatever, has sort of said, actually, well, in fact, I think there's a new person in charge of that and has basically sort of said, well, actually, we're open to the possibility of handing it over to a football club afterwards, whereas the previous incumbent, whoever it was pretty much against it. So
Tessa Jowell was originally against it because Tessa Jowell was part of the London Olympic, albeit a minor one, and part of the London Olympic bid. Mm. And the agreement, one of the conditions in getting the bid, was that the Olympic Stadium remain a dedicated athletic stadium. Afterwards, it was going to have its capacity reduced to 25,000 and remain as an athletic stadium, and that apparently is set in stone in contract. Now, of course, it's all very well saying that it's set in stone, but the thing is, they've got the Olympics now and they're building it, so I guess there's nothing to stop them from necessarily reneging on the contract and saying, to hell with it, we're going to demolish the athletics track, we're going to do what we did to the City of Manchester Stadium. But people should perhaps be slightly aware that if West Ham do move, they may well, without running the risk of getting sued by the IOC, have to keep that athletics track. It won't necessarily be the same deal as the City of Manchester Stadium. And there's a lot to happen between now and then, but I mean, as things are at the moment, that's the situation. So, but I'm with you, Chris. I think there's reason for guarded optimism with the with the West Ham at the moment. Golden Sutherland, as they pointed out themselves, are tax-paying millionaires living in. They're not non-doms. You know, they're. I mean, okay, they've made money selling dildos, but you know, they're good quality dildos, damn it. And you know, fair play to them.
Yeah, I mean that's it. And I was quietly sort of optimistic that they've sort of said they're West Ham fans. They've had shares in West Ham in the past. They've tried to take over West Ham in the past. They claim to basically see West Ham from the point of view of all the other supporters, which I dare say is quite possible. And I think they're going about, they're shrewd businessmen, and I'm cautiously optimistic that they will be good for West Ham. The only slight worry for me was last week when they sort of said, we've offered £100,000 to a special player to help us get out of, to help us to avoid relegation. And I thought, oh no, don't say they're going to kind of go about making these brash kind of headline grabbing gestures. I just thought that's the last thing we want. But, you know, one player isn't going to stop us getting relegated. But we'll see how that. It was claimed to have been possibly Ruud van Nistelrooy, although I know it's not going to be.
I saw an interview with David Gold this evening, and fair play to him. You see, he was saying, you know, offering someone like van Nistelrooy £100,000 a week for 4 months isn't like offering someone £50,000 a week for 4 years. So it's not those sort of things, but he says if we can have someone like that for 4 months and he can stop us from getting relegated, then that's worth that investment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good call. I mean, he, as it happens, he's at Hamburg and they won't be paying him much less than that. And he's got a 1.5 year deal. So, I mean, how that works out for Hamburg could be pretty terrifying for them because, you know, the situation in the Bundesliga isn't as insecure as it is in the Premier League, but it's, you know, that's still a heck of a lot of money. They're putting it's a huge punt for Hamburg.
He'll score a hell of a lot of goals there.
If he's fit, Graham, yeah, of course he'll score goals. I mean, you know, Jermaine Beckford could score goals in the Bundesliga, but I mean, you know, so, yeah, you know, that's a good one. But, I think West Ham had dodged a bullet with Van Nistelrooy, but, you know.
Well, I'm hearing this evening a breaking story that apparently the West Ham have put in a written bid for Benny McCarthy. So we'll see how that one pans out. But we won't dwell on that for the time being. Time is pushing us on. So there we go. There's our take on the whole West Ham thing. And we'll keep you up to date with that as it goes on, as I say. Now then, African Cup of Nations, that's been going on too. And since we last spoke, we've got into the quarterfinal stage. In fact, probably as of around about now, as we're speaking, it's probably the end of the quarterfinals. The semi-finals going on this Thursday, but we've had the four quarterfinals, of which the hosts Angola have been knocked out 1-0 by Ghana. Egypt went out earlier on this evening, 3-1 to Egypt on extra time. But possibly the key result, certainly from the point of view of England supporters, was Algeria's 3-2 win over Ivory Coast last night, again after extra time. That means that Algeria now face Egypt in the semi-finals, and this is where we're really going to, I think, chaps, we're going to get to see what Algeria are all about ahead of the World Cup, is it not? I think, Graham, you said you saw some of the Algeria's game against Ivory Coast in a quarter-final match last night. What were your thoughts?
It was fascinating. It was very interesting. I think the game, the level of gamesmanship showed by the Algerians is something that will have to be looked out for, because the Algerian goalkeeper was down for about 7 minutes of the second half of injury time.
Funny how it's always the goalkeepers that get these life-threatening injuries at that stage of the game.
Yeah, who for all intents and purposes looked like he'd been cleanly knocked out. and yet was up and about and sprightly as anything when the next cross was coming in. They are eking their way through this tournament, but they are doing it, and they're showing that they know how to play tournament football, which is going to make them a tough prospect when England come against them in the summer.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw any of it, Tel, but I mean, from what I saw last night, I mean, basically, Ivory Coast got an early goal after about 4 or 5 minutes, and what seemed to happen to me was that Ivory Coast then immediately sort of took their foot off the gas and thought, well, okay, good, fine, we've got our early goal, we'll just settle back, and it was because they didn't seem bothered about getting a second goal that's what allowed Algeria to come back into it, and then we had all the hoo-ha going on right at the end. as well, whereas we sort of saw goals going in and the game getting into extra time. Have you seen much of Algeria, Terry, and what are your thoughts generally on the competition thus far?
Well, I saw the game between Egypt and Cameroon this afternoon. I got home, and I was surprised at how poor it was. I have to say, I was quite frustrated watching it, because between the referee and between, you know, and I have to say, I think largely the Egyptians sort of, like, you know, unwillingness to allow the game to develop any kind of rhythm. I just got really frustrated watching the game, and I detect that perhaps this might be a bit of a theme going on there throughout the tournament generally. I think it's not been as fluid a tournament as, say, Ghana was the last time around, which was generally speaking really good. I mean, the Egyptians, the Tunisians, the North Africans were awesome. You know, the Ghana themselves put on a great show and were really enthusiastic. Something tells me that those pitches there are pretty ropey. The way those guys fall over when they go down, you look at them and they think, that looks tough and unpleasant. The goalkeeping's been quite comedic, which makes me wonder whether or not perhaps they haven't got a great deal of confidence in the surface underneath them. Because, I mean, these aren't bad goalkeepers. They're just, you know, but I mean, I'm not convinced that this, unfortunately, is going to go down as a vintage tournament.
I don't think so as well. And in fact, just going back to the Algeria Ivory Coast match last night, the commentators on Eurosport were saying how, oh, you know, time has flown by in this match and it's been absolutely fantastic. And I thought, actually, the exciting and the good bit was actually right at the end. And actually, neither side looked that great to me. And as you say, that may be symptomatic of the whole competition in general.
Yeah, but yet again as well, there was another important decision that made wrongly at the end of that game when Ivory Coast got a perfectly valid equaliser. Called off for offside.
I saw the last 15 minutes. I only saw the last half of extra time. I mean, if that is in any way indicative of the way that they played over the entire piece, the Ivory Coast, they didn't deserve anything. You know, they can't be harping about disallowed goals.
No, because they're
plenty good enough to beat that lot. And and I was alarmed at just the lack of spirit that they showed. I mean, yes. I can't believe they'll play like that in the World Cup. I refuse to believe that.
The thing is, the semi-finals are only Zambia and Nigeria are still playing extra time at the moment. It's still 0-0, and they've only just started to kick off the second half at this moment. But the semi-finals on Thursday, you've got Algeria against Egypt, which should be a fantastic spectacle. It really is just about things that are not to do with football. This is basically just two teams that are basically at war with each other. And you're not going to see a great game of football there. You're just going to see a very, very niggly, very hard, a brutal game, I would imagine.
Interestingly
enough, or we may see, or may not, we may see a really, really tame game between two teams playing. Now that it's over, they might just have had all their energy spent. And Algeria, again, I mean, how focused are they on the World Cup? Do they have the appetite for a war?
Yeah.
You know, Egypt may end up steamrolling them because they'll be all up for war and revenge. And Algeria are like, well, look, we haven't got the stomach for this. We're in the World Cup. You know, we don't want to get ourselves. This is not the last game of our careers. We're not going to play it like the last game of our careers. So it could go the other way.
Right. Indeed. Well, I think we've got to pretty much wrap it up there. But just going back very briefly to one point you're saying about the goalkeeper, and a lot of people have been talking about the poor goalkeeping, and somebody said that of the 53 group stage goals in this competition, 23 have been attributed to poor goalkeeping. So discuss, everyone, as we go off and draw this podcast to a close. That's it for this particular edition of The Sound of Football. Thank you very much indeed to Terry and Graham, as ever, for joining me. Don't forget, listeners, you can catch us at the Sound of Football blog site, our Sound of Football Facebook fan page, and also at Some People Are on the Pitch and The Onion Bag. But for this week, I fear that is it. Thanks very much indeed for listening. We hope to have the pleasure of your company again next week. But for now, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.